Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another very live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital, author of the book Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse, and the host of the show for the next hour. And I am taking your calls live. The phone number is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I'm going to try to go to the phones relatively quickly tonight because I haven't had a chance to eat anything. And so I'm going to need a quick break at the beginning of the show while some of the callers call in so I can eat something. And I actually just pulled it out of the oven as I'm talking here. A couple of quick announcements. I will be on Fox, Cavuto on Business on Fox News. That's the network that people can actually see. I'll be on that one on Saturday morning. I tape it, but it shows at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. 7:30 a.m. Pacific time. And I've been told by Fox that I'm going to be doing these shows quite a bit in the new year. It might be a regular thing where I show up on one of those Fox News shows. They've got four shows on this Cost of Freedom. You know, I've done them periodically in the past, but they come on Saturday morning from 10 a.m. To noon on the East Coast and from 7 a.m. To 9 a.m. on the West Coast. And I think they repeat them again on Sunday. I'm not really sure what the time slot is when they repeat them. But you can watch them. And, of course, I try to get them up on my website. But I should be on – I'm not specifically going to be on any one show yet. I might – you know, they might alternate me. They have four shows. There's one called Bulls and Bears, which I've been on many times. The one Cavuto on Business, which I'm going to be on again, which I'm going to be on tomorrow, that I've done. And there's two more shows that I've never done. One of them is called Cashing In, and another one is Forbes on Fox. So I haven't done either of those two shows yet. So, but the first one I will be on Saturday on Cavuto show. In fact, I just did his show on Fox Business. He was out. Stuart Varney was guest hosting, and I just left from that one. I just got back to do this show. And anyway, the number to call again is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And let me go ahead and take the first caller. I've only got one person on hold. But I'll take a quick caller and I'll have a bite to eat. Go ahead, David.
Don't talk with your mouth full now.
I'm listening.
I wanted to ask, what do you think is going to happen with all of these millions of foreclosures? Somehow I just can't see all these people out walking out on the street. Is the government going to step in and just say you can't foreclose? What's your prediction of what's going to happen with this mess?
I don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, one of the loan bright spots for the U.S. economy right now is we got plenty of houses. So people aren't going to be homeless. People aren't going to be on the street. Just because somebody's house goes into foreclosure doesn't mean that they can't live there or that somebody else can't live there. There's still a housing unit that can be occupied by somebody and will be occupied by somebody. So people are going to have places to live. That's not going to be one of our problems. The problems are going to be, how do you pay for the heat? How do you pay for the electricity? How do you pay for the maintenance? How do you buy a lot of things? But housing is not going to be one of our problems for a while
because we built so many houses. We built more houses than we really need. So homelessness and people out on the street is not going to be the problem. But I don't, you know, there's no way the government can stop housing prices from falling because they're too high. You know, the only way they can stop it is to create a lot of inflation, which they're already trying to do, and maybe they'll succeed. But if they keep, you know, nominal prices levitated, real prices are going to decline even more, which is prices relative to other goods. You know, I mentioned today on Fox, I thought the big news story for today was soybean prices. You know, soybean prices went through $12 a bushel for the first time in over 34 years. We're going to have beans in the teens now any day, certainly I think in the first part of January. And, you know, their prices could go much, much higher. I can see soybeans, you know, above $20 a bushel potentially next year. And these, this is a very inflation-sensitive commodity, a leading indicator. And I think when you start to see, you know, beans moving the way they are, you know, there's a lot of inflation out there.
Maybe if I could ask that in a different way, are the banks going to be willing, you know, to take these houses, you know, and lose, you know, huge sums of money on them? Are they going to be more inclined to just say, you know...
They're going to have to. I mean, the question is, the money has already been lost. I mean, they already made loans, and the houses are not worth the values of the loans. So what are they going to do? I mean, the banks don't want to be in the real estate business. I mean, they don't want to just own a bunch of real estate. They want to sell it. They just assume get some cash, you know, from a new buyer. But, you know, they don't want to just carry it on their books, and they've got to get they've got to get real owners in the property. See, the problem for the banks or any lenders is if the current owners are way upside down in their mortgage, which is likely the case for most people, and they continue to reside in those properties, they're not going to maintain them. They have no financial incentive to fix their leaky roof or repair a cracked foundation. So the houses are going to get into increasingly worse shape the longer they don't foreclose. And, you know, people are likely not to pay their taxes and other association dues. And so these are just bigger liabilities that are going to be added to the lenders if they don't get the current tenants out of there, the current owners out of there, and replace them with somebody else, or at least renegotiate the loan with the current tenant, bring down the value of the mortgage so that they have some equity and some incentive to actually maintain those properties.
You think that's what will happen, is they'll basically just write down the amount of the mortgage?
Well, ultimately, that's going to happen. They'll write down the amount of the mortgage. Or, I mean, if the current occupants of the homes have no money, see, I don't think it would make sense for a current occupant to just say, okay, we'll reduce your mortgage. I think what they need is new cash. So they have to do these deals with homeowners who have money. Let's say there's, you know, say, go to a homeowner and say, I'll tell you what, you got a $500,000 mortgage on your house. I'll knock it down to $300,000, but you got to kick in $20,000. You know, you got to actually write a check, give me some cash, you give me $20,000, I'll take $200,000 off your debt. But do something to show that this guy has just put some money into this property so that they've got some financial incentives to maintain it. Otherwise, they're probably better off selling them to somebody who does. And also making sure that people have the money to maintain them. You know, too many people are in over their heads. Too many people own houses that shouldn't own them.
But these people facing foreclosure, basically by definition, they have no cash to kick in, right?
You don't know that. I mean, there could be people that have cash, but, you know, they don't want to put it into a house, you know, where the mortgage is $500,000 and the house is worth $300,000. People aren't stupid, you know. And, you know, somebody might have a house and they might have a vacation house. I mean, who knows? But, I mean, things are going to work themselves out in the free market as long as the government stay out. But there is no painless resolution. A lot of money is going to be lost by a lot of people who are foolish enough to lend money to Americans to speculate on houses. And a lot of other Americans who own houses are going to have to come back to reality with respect to their financial situation. That, yes, they might own a house, but that's what they own. They don't have a lottery ticket, a goose that lays golden eggs. They don't have they're not going to be able to retire because they're homeowners. If they want to retire, they better work and they better save a lot of money.
I'd like to tell you something Jim Cramer said, if you could react to it. You know that Paulson plan where they're going to quit, they're going to, you know, not foreclose, they're going to...
Yeah, I know the Paulson plan. They're trying to freeze payments on the
yeah.
for 5 years on some of the worst subprime loans.
Yeah. here's what Jim Cramer said, is that the real purpose of that plan, he says it's a genius plan, and he said the real purpose of it is not to save the homeowners, but he said the real purpose of it is to make it so that bank examiners can't do their job, so that when they come into a bank and look at the books and they say you have all these non-performing loans, the bank can say, oh, not necessarily.
Your questions are a little bit too long-winded, so I thank you for the call. I want to move on. But I disagree with what Cramer is saying. I don't think that that is the primary purpose. I mean, that's not going to do anything to help or the financial condition of the banks just because some of these loans are frozen. I think the main purpose of this is political. The government is trying to act as if they're doing something. They're trying to score points with voters and potential homeowners. But whatever they're doing is likely to create more damage. In fact, I had an op-ed piece, one of my old commentaries, which you've read, I kind of submitted it as an op-ed piece to the New York Times, which ran today. You know, I submitted it 2 or 3 weeks ago. This is how long it took the Times to run my piece. And, of course, they cut out a lot. There was a lot more important stuff in there, but they kept cutting it down. And, you know, there was a recent op-ed, too, in the New York Times that I wrote a response to, and I wish they had ran it. It was a very good, concise response. But there was a piece in there written by Paul Krugman, who was being very critical now of Alan Greenspan because the Fed didn't interfere or regulate the mortgage market to prevent this problem, and he blames the Fed's lack of intervention, you know, beforehand on Alan Greenspan's steadfast belief in free market capitalism and how good the market is. And he was going back to some quotes from Alan Greenspan from the 1960s to show that Alan Greenspan, you know, just let the free market run amok. And here's the result. And so the solution is we got to rein in the free market. We need more government. We need more regulation. And, of course, my response was that this was nonsense. It's not the old Alan Greenspan who believed in freedom and capitalism that caused this problem. It's the new statist, a fiat money creation, bubble-blowing Alan Greenspan. It wasn't not enough government that caused the problem. It was too much government involvement in the money supply. Alan Greenspan blew up this bubble by bringing interest rates down and creating so much money. That's what happened. The fact that what Greenspan did caused free market, you know, malinvestments and caused too much money to flow into the real estate market and caused a lot of people to gamble on real estate prices, that's not the fault of the free market. That's the fault of the false signals that Alan Greenspan sent to the free market. If Greenspan acted responsibly and provided sound money and high interest rates, we never would have had a real estate bubble. So I wish they'd have ran. I had a very concise argument there, but I wish they would have ran that piece. But at least they ran my piece today. I got it up on my website if you're not in the New York area, if you don't have access to the New York Times. But it's basically almost a word for word taken from one of my commentaries, just shortened up a little bit and a little new stuff. Anyway, let me take a call from Steve in California.
Hey, Peter. I was wondering, what's your view on the Visa IPO coming up? You know, at American Express at 52 weeks lows, 52 at around 52, but MasterCard at 209, 52 highs. And what's your view on Visa?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is obvious. What to do on that IPO? Don't participate.
Yeah, I was shorting MasterCard, but it's still flying high. I was like, it's just a processing. It's a process. It just processes.
These guys, these are terrible businesses involved in.
You know,
there are huge losses in there. That's like buying MasterCard or Visa right now would be like buying into a subprime mortgage lender last year. Yeah, you know, I just wrote my commentary that'll be on my website by Friday, but the focus of this commentary was the subprime-like problem that I see developing next year in bonds backed by securitized credit card debt and auto loans.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, and basically what has been going on is that these products, loans, credit card loans and auto loans, had very low defaults for a long time. And it created a false sense of confidence in this. And so a lot of money was loaned. But remember, in the automobile realm, right, a lot of people, credit has been so lax in the automobile that people were able to go a few years ago, take their cars, you know, let's say you had a used car and you had a $30,000 loan on it and the car was worth $25,000. You can go in there and buy a new $40,000 car, and they would add the $5,000 that you were upside down into your new loan, make it $45,000, and give you a sweetheart deal amortized over 6 years. And there was all kinds of lax financing where people were able to make these car payments, but you know they're really upside down on their collateral. And then also when it came to credit cards, in the credit card market, there were a lot of people who were rolling over, constantly rolling over their balances, where you'd run up a credit card debt and then you get an offer, balance transfer, you know, no interest for 6 months or 3% interest for the first 6 months. So there were these serial transfers going from card to card, and then people were also able to, you know, to pay off their credit cards with home equity loans or make good on their car loans with home equity loans and constantly, shuffle around their debt and transfer their non-tax-deductible high-interest rate debt to tax-deductible low-interest mortgage debt. All this is gone. I mean, the music has stopped, and I think there's going to be a huge collapse. People are going to lose a fortune that own these bonds, and you're going to see the same type of seize-up in credit cards and auto loans like you're seeing in subprime. And so just like now it's very difficult for people to qualify for mortgages, next year it's going to be very hard for people to buy cars or to use their credit cards to buy merchandise.
But they're just processing. Isn't MasterCard and Visa just processing, and then just the bank owns them, but it just processes, it skims off the top a little bit, like one per letter?
Well, it doesn't matter. Whatever they do, people are going to be using their credit cards a lot less frequently because they're not going to have the credit. People are going to be maxed out. The credit limits are going to be reduced. So even if those companies, and I doubt it, don't hold the paper and have the liability for defaults, certainly there's going to be a lot less usage of credit cards because Americans are not going to be shopping nearly as much.
I see.
Yeah.
So it's a bad idea even to how about shorting MasterCard? It's a 200. I'm like, people have been trying to short that thing for like last 2 years, and it's like, whoa, it's like.
I'm not short stock, so I don't know, but I mean, it certainly sounds like a good candidate for somebody who's looking to short things.
Okay.
There's a lot of interesting shorts out there, so that certainly could be one of them. Thanks for the call, Steve. Have you read my book yet?
Yes, I have.
All right, great.
I'm a client already. Thanks a lot, though.
Nice to hear from you. And I've got Elliot on the line also from California. Go ahead, Elliot.
Hey, Peter. I'm sure you probably noticed your last commentary from last week has been making the rounds on the various financial blogs, and there's been rebuttals posted, and I think you posted a re-rebuttal on one of them. And I was just trying to make sense of the conversation. I had a few questions about that for you.
Yeah.
So would you agree that, you know, if the economy were left to its own devices, i.e., you know, let's imagine the government didn't try to interfere, that the effect of the credit bubble popping would be deflationary?
Well, it's not going to be deflation. See, the problem, I knew that there'd be a lot of controversy with that particular piece, because there's so many people who also envision problems that think, okay, bubbles deflate and prices fall. That's
right.
They do. But prices fall in terms of real money, gold. They don't necessarily fall in terms of fiat, because the government can simply create money, and they will create money. And even if, you know, if people say, well, what if the banks don't want to loan it out? They don't have to loan it out. They can do it. Whatever they do with it, it's going to get into the global money supply. Plus, of course, what's probably going to happen in the next couple of years is the government's going to increase payments, you know, welfare payments or higher unemployment benefits, or maybe they'll cut taxes and just print the difference, or who knows. But the government is going to continue to create money. In addition, the trillions of dollars that we've already created that are owned by foreigners and that are invested right now in bonds and stocks, a lot of that money is going to get spent. Even if a large fraction of it is lost, what isn't lost is going to be spent. Right now, none of it is being spent. It's in our debt. But when foreigners try to use those dollars to buy stuff, it's going to force prices up. But there will be deflation in the sense that real estate prices, stock prices, and probably even, you know, merchandise, consumer goods, services, all prices are going to fall in gold. But I don't think the only prices that might fall in terms of dollars, in terms of paper dollars, would be assets, such as U.S. real estate or U.S. stocks. They can certainly fall. But and maybe even U.S. services. I mean, as far as, you know, if you want to get a haircut or you want to get a massage from somebody or, you know, you want to go to a restaurant. I mean, those types of prices could easily come down, you know. But consumer goods, you know, goods that are global in nature, you know, items, you know, clothing, you know, apparel, you know, electronics, you know, furniture, food, energy, all those things. In terms of U.S. dollars, the prices are only going to go up. There's no chance that they're going to go down. And there's no chance that the U.S. dollar is going to become more valuable, you know, as a result of a collapse of the U.S. economy. When our markets collapse, our housing market, we go into a recession, the result is not going to be foreigners are, gee, I want more dollars. You only buy those dollars, you know. That's not going to happen.
Well, so one comment on that I saw was, if you consider the case of Japan, you know, they went through a similar situation and their government tried to spend their way out of the recession, lowered interest rates to basically nothing, and had huge stimulus packages.
There's a huge difference between America and Japan, all right?
Okay.
Japan has a huge savings rate, has a huge trade surplus, has a huge current account surplus. So there's real demand for the yen. They need to base their currency. But the Japanese productive machine was so efficient that even though the Japanese debased their money, the Japanese produced so many more goods to give their money value. And so it's a different situation. You know, we're not going to follow the Japanese scenario. If you want to look at a situation that's similar, look at Argentina. You know, you've got to look at some, if you want to look at a major economy that we're following in the footsteps of, it's Argentina, it's not Japan. And in the Argentine example, hyperinflation is what resulted. And, you know, we're not Japan. Unfortunately, we're in a much, much worse situation than Japan. You know, Japan was lending money around the world. They weren't borrowing money. You know, they didn't have to worry about the world yanking yen, cashing in their Japanese investments. That couldn't happen. It's the Japanese that owned investments all around the world as the largest creditor. So when you have the largest creditor and the largest debtor, Japan was the largest creditor, and we're the largest debtor, you can't expect the experiences to be the same.
Right. And one last comment. On your point that lots of foreigners hold our debt right now, and essentially we've written checks that they're not cashing yet, and you're saying that they will cash them at some point.
Yes.
If you look at the size of, let's say, the national debt that's held by foreigners, it's about, you know, $4 to $5 trillion, I believe. And consumer spending in the U.S. is about $10 trillion a year. So even if they do spend all that money, consumer spending, let's say, falls off by half. You know, if the foreigners spend all that money, that will offset it for 1 year. What happens after that?
No, I'm saying all that money is going to come into our domestic pool of money to bid up.
So I'm saying there's $5 trillion of it being held right now by various foreign central banks.
Yeah, and the act of
it will come back here, but assuming consumers falls off a cliff.
The act of foreigners spending those dollars means they have to sell their treasury bonds. They just can't spend them until they sell the bonds, and so that drives up interest rates through the roof. So it's not like they can just spend them in a vacuum. So first they've got to sell their treasuries to do it. So interest rates have to go way up too. So the U.S. economy collapses. So the reduction in consumer spending by Americans will be enormous. Of course, unless the federal government just creates more and more money, which is what they're going to do. So in addition to all the foreign dollars coming back to this country, the Fed's going to be running off new ones off the printing presses as well.
Well, I guess that's what I'm saying.
The Fed is probably going to step up and buy a lot of these treasuries that the Europeans and the Asians are unloading, because there's no private demand in America for those treasuries. So the only way the demand is going to show up is if the Federal Reserve supplies it.
Well, sure. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, if, you know, I agree consumption here in the States is going to fall off tremendously. And, you know, normally that would be deflationary because there would be less demand for consumer items. But you're saying the foreigners will come in and money that they're holding, the debt that they're holding right now.
Of course. I mean, Americans are going to get poorer. That's the problem. Just because
agree with that.
We consume less doesn't mean the rest of the world consumes less. The rest of the world's going to consume more. You know, prices are determined in a global market, not in the American market. So just because Americans can't afford to buy things doesn't mean that the prices have to come down when foreigners can afford them. In fact, foreigners are going to be a lot wealthier by definition as the dollar declines. Now, if all currencies declined equally, then, you know, maybe my argument wouldn't work. But I don't expect that to happen. I don't expect the currencies in Asia to fall. They've got to go up. They've got to rise. You know, that this is how they're going to get rewarded for all their hard work and all their productivity. They're going to get richer because their currencies are going to become more valuable. And so many things that are being exported to us are not going to be exported here anymore. I mean, you can think, gee, there'll be a lot less demand. Yeah, but what's going to be on the shelves? Sure, Americans are going to buy less, but there's going to be a lot less for them to buy. So you look at, you know, the people who are arguing that, you know, prices falling and deflation, they look at the decline in demand, but they don't look at the decline in supply. There's going to be a huge decline in supply of consumer goods in the United States. But anyway, hey, Elliot, thanks for the call, and I want to take another quick break and play another commercial, and we'll be back for more calls.
Euro Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro Pacific Capital.
Okay, we are back, and the number to call is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I'll go back to the phones with Steve in Georgia.
Hey, Peter, I really appreciate your economic outlook and your investment advice. I'm very interested in the gold through the Perth Mint program. And my question has to do with gold prices in the 70s. I know it went from $35 to about $800. How long did it take for that rise to occur, and then what happened afterwards? How far and how fast did it far within, did it fall?
Remember, gold was at $35 an ounce until Nixon devalued the dollar and raised gold up to $40 an ounce and then $42 an ounce. And I think it was at $42 an ounce. And I think in 1968, it was still $35 an ounce. I think by 1971, I might be off by a year or so. But by 1971, they had devalued twice, and gold was at $42 an ounce. But meanwhile, the gold was taking huge portions of our gold out. And we were losing a lot of gold. And so at some point, Nixon just said, look, we're going to stop this. And they closed the gold window, so they said. And then gold prices quickly, I think, within a few years, went from $42 an ounce up to $100, $125, $150. And then I think they might have trended sideways for a year or two. And then I think the meteoric rise again happened between like 1978 and 1980. Gold probably went from 200 or something up to 800, and it only traded above 800, I think, on 2 days. And I think within a week of it being above 800, it was back in the 600s again. So it was a real climactic speculative move at the end. And it also happened around when the Hunt brothers went to corner the silver market, and they drove silver up to $50 an ounce. But remember, silver had started to run basically it was a dollar an ounce. You know, I mean, a dollar, you know, four quarters was, you know, was a dollar, and it was, you know, I think it was 80% of an ounce, right? So, I mean, silver was about a dollar an ounce, and then it went to 50, so it was a huge move. But it didn't take that long. But then gold collapsed, and silver, but it never went down. Gold never went anywhere near the $35 or the $42 an ounce where it started. I mean, it did get down. The lowest it got was back in 1999 when it got back down to about 250 and change. That was the lowest it got after it hit 800. So that's still, you know, eight times where it began the rally. And it's interesting that whenever I go on television and try to talk about what a good investment gold is, the one thing they always say is, well, if you'd have bought it in 1980 at 800, here it is, 28, 30 years later, and you're break even. I mean, they always look at gold at 800 as if that's when everybody bought it. But, you know, what if you bought it 10 years earlier? You got more money than if you bought the Dow Jones at that time, not counting dividends. I mean, but But they always look at if you bought it at the peak of the mania. But, you know, certainly over the last 8 years, gold has outperformed stocks dramatically. It's done it again this year. I think gold is up maybe 17, 20% or whatever on the year. Gold's around 810, something like that. But I expect gold to move a lot higher. I think technically it looks really good. I think that, you know, you're going to see a move above $1,000 an ounce in 2008. You know, maybe we can move substantially above 1,000, but I think gold will trade above 1,000 in 2008. And ultimately, when it does take off, I expect gold to be at several thousand dollars an ounce. I mean, I think there's a good chance that gold will be worth the Dow, the same as the Dow, whatever the Dow happens to be. Now, again, that could mean gold 5,000, Dow 5,000. It can mean gold 7,500, Dow 7,500. Or it can mean gold 20,000, Dow 20,000. It doesn't really matter how they meet. What's important is the revaluation, and that's the deflation that I'm talking about. You know, that's why I called my article Not Your Father's Deflation, because this is going to be a deflation. Assets are going to lose value. Asset prices are going to deflate. Goods prices are going to deflate in terms of real money, in terms of gold. They probably will deflate in terms of other currencies. In terms of the Chinese yuan, I expect prices for everything to drop because the yuan is too cheap. So there could be certain currencies and certain economies that might experience that type of a deflation where consumer goods, you know, become less expensive. But countries like the United States are not going to experience that at all.
Okay, then. Now, I definitely appreciate your advice. And I do kind of think 6% is a little high. I believe I'd...
What?
In terms of commission.
Who charges 6%?
Your firm would.
Buy gold?
No. I'm talking about a portfolio of foreign stocks.
We don't charge 6%. I mean, generally people pay 2 to 3%. Some people pay 3.5%, depending on how small the portfolio is. But I'd say the average commission is about 3%. And, you know, some people pay 2%. Some people pay 1%. It depends on how big the investment is. But for a typical portfolio of several hundred thousand dollars, somebody would pay 3%. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, it's not cheap, but it's a lot. It's not 6%. But over time, you know, my average client holds their stock, for practically forever. I've got clients who first became my clients 10 years ago, and most of the stocks that I bought them 10 years ago, if they haven't been bought out by other companies, they're still in their accounts today. So you take that 3% commission and say, well, over 10 years, well, I've charged them a third of a percent, you know, 30 basis points per year, which is a steal.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, they don't have a lot of turnover, so they don't pay a lot of taxes. You know, there's no management fees. And, you know, this is the way you invest. You know, this is the Warren Buffett style. You buy stocks and you never sell them. And what makes my strategy work is because I buy stocks that pay good dividends. That's why you don't want to sell them. You don't have to sell them. You get compensated for owning them because you get a good chunk of the profits. All the companies I'm buying, it's not the CEOs and the big boys who are raking in all the profits for themselves and bonuses and fat salaries. The profits are going to my clients who are the owners of the companies and who deserve to make the profits. And the cost, and plus, you know, we're buying stocks overseas and cutting out the market makers. I mean, you think 3% is high, try paying 10 or 20% to some market maker on the pink sheets. That they really slaughter you, and they don't even know you. They don't even help you. They don't even help you choose the stocks. They just stand there and scalp you. You know, you don't even see them.
So don't
be put off by a 3% commission. Believe me, you know, you're losing a lot more money, but you know, not worrying about the 3%. You know, it's penny wise and pound foolish. You know, the dollar is going to lose a lot more than 3% of its value most likely in the next year. So you're better off getting rid of your dollars before that happens.
So when people become clients with you, is there something in the contract stating that you can't change the commission on the back end when they decide to sell?
Well, I can't prevent you from transferring your account out. So, and we don't have this power of attorney over these things. So we just can't sell you and charge you a higher commission. So,
right.
But when it comes time to sell something, If you think we're charging you too much, you can transfer your account someplace else and say, you know what, don't sell it. I'm going to transfer it to another firm because they said they're going to do it cheaper. So, I mean, I we don't have a contract that says we're never going to lower the commissions or raise the commissions, but, you know, we can't force you to pay them if you don't want to. But my commissions have pretty much been the same, you know, the whole time I've been in the business. And, you know, and it depends on the circumstances. Like, we had a client, I know I have a client now that's selling a bunch of stock that he bought a month ago, and we're barely charging him. I'm just doing it at my cost. I mean, so it depends on the circumstances. People think, oh, just because I charge you 3% to buy it, it doesn't mean if you have to sell it next week, you know, in the short run, because you have a financial emergency, that I'm going to stick you with that kind of a commission. I'm charging you the 3% with the assumption that you're going to be in that stock for a long time. And if you're not in that stock for a long time, I'm certainly not going to charge you another 3% to sell it. Now, if you're in that stock for a few years and, you know, we decide to sell it, some of it, because it's quadrupled, or for whatever reason we want to, or you want to sell some, and you've made a lot of money. Then, you know, that there's a good chance that I might charge you again, because you've made a tremendous amount of money in the stock. You know, but even then, depending on what you do with the proceeds, you know, if you buy something else, then no, there's no way we're going to charge you that much again, unless, of course, you're talking about a very small order, in which case we need to charge a high percentage just so we don't lose money on the deals. People forget that there's a lot of costs involved in doing these foreign stocks, and just because we charge you a commission doesn't mean we put it all in our pocket. You know, some of it has to go to pay the cost of doing the trade, and, of course, I have a lot of overhead that enables me to do these trades. There's a lot of... Sure. When people just buy IBM or Cisco, you know, it's all automated. It's very easy. We just push buttons and it goes automatically. But in order to do these foreign trades directly on these foreign markets, there's a lot of human interaction. There's a lot of writing things and talking to people and manually doing things. And so there's more room for errors or people doing mistakes. So it's more costly. So, you know, that's why so many other firms don't do it. They don't want to bother with it.
Okay. So I'm almost sold. My last concern is, it has to do with me being very young. I'm in my late 20s, worth about $150,000, and all dividends and capital gains in my mutual funds have been reinvested. And so, I mean, over the next 30 years, you know, I see a lot of, you know, additional commissions on top of those reinvestments.
What you got to do is don't focus so much on the commission. Look, you got to reinvest. You got to get your money allocated properly. I mean, the thing is, you're young, so even if inflation wiped out your $150,000 and you started from scratch, you still have plenty of time to earn money. But, you know, I'd hate to see that happen. You'd be much better off preserving and building on that money. And so what you want to do is get it into good stocks right now. And if you follow my approach, over the next 20 or 30 years, you'll pay no commissions. You'll pay me 3%, you know, next week or next month to invest that money, and then you won't pay me another quarter. You know, you'll pay me when you send new money in, but that $150,000, if we buy some stocks and hold them 20 or 30 years from now, when you want to retire, you'll still own those stocks. And you know what? The dividends will be huge, and that's why you'll be able to retire, because you'll be making all this dividend income from your stocks. You won't need wage income from your labor.
All right, then.
Well, follow me? And that's my goal. My goal is not to have you buy stocks and then turn around and have you sell them. My goal is to buy you stocks that you never have to sell. Your grandchildren can sell those stocks. You don't have to sell them. You want to own them. You want to keep them. You want to collect the dividends and live off the income that they produce.
Sure.
And you want the dividends to go up over time, which I think they will. If we're buying good companies that are growing their earnings, they're also increasing their dividends. And, of course, the stock prices will go up. They'll follow the dividends. But who cares what the stock price is, because we're not going to sell them.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what somebody else thinks our stocks are worth. What matters is what they're worth as measured by how much income we receive by owning them.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We're looking forward to having you on board.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Okay. And who are we on? Am I on Steve in Georgia? Or was that Steve? Am I on Andrew in Illinois? Who's on hold?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's Andrew in Florida.
Hey, Andy.
All right. So I just finished reading your book, Crash Proof, a couple months ago. I found about you two after you endorsed Ron Paul. And so that was a good PR move for you guys. I think you got a lot of exposure to that. But my question relates to my future a little bit. I'm a college student. I'm just getting ready to enter the workforce after I graduate here. And I'm kind of worried about where the income is going to shift to, because right now there's so many dead jobs in the service and like paper industries. And I study engineering, and I'm really looking into semiconductors and computer, chip making. And I think that's an area where the United States is still strong in production. And I was wondering what your outlook was. Where are going to be the exports that are going to help us pay for all this?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, yeah, certainly we have certain areas of technology where we're doing well. And, you know, I had an argument today on Fox, you know, when they were talking about Warren Buffett bought into this company. And, you know, people thought, you know, oh, is this showing he's really confident in the American consumer? And I said, well, I don't think so. I think if you look at what he bought, they're heavy into manufacturing. They're into mining and agriculture. They have international operations. And I think Buffett is trying to prepare for a reindustrialized America that's going to be more, you know, export-oriented and producing. And you know, the commentator Varney was arguing with me, saying, no, no, we'll never be a manufacturing economy again. I said, well, if that's the case, then we're going to have to stop consuming because we're not going to be able to buy products if we can't either make them or trade people or trade for them. We're not just going to be able to keep buying them on credit like we have been buying. But, you know, I don't know exactly which are going to be the best companies or industries to be in, but definitely you want to go towards things that we can make and that we can export, and you want to stay away from businesses that are centered on American consumption. I think that certainly the legal profession is going to be, retrenching, and, you know, any of the white-collar type service sector jobs, I think, you know, that those would not be doing well under the economy that I envision.
Yeah, I understand. And my question is about
On Ron Paul. You know, I didn't. You know, when I endorsed him, I didn't endorse him for PR reasons.
I understand completely, but it worked out. But a lot of people probably found out about you and your Pacific.
It's hard to
through that.
I mean, some people find out about me because I endorse them and like me. Other people see that I endorse them and they don't like me because I like somebody else. So you don't know whether you win more than you lose. Also, I guess a lot of the Ron Paul supporters, he has a lot of real grassroots supporters. I don't know how many of them have enough, you know, income to really be clients. I don't know. I mean, I think it says something that he gets a lot of supporters, just blue collar, you know, working men and women supporting him. It's not a bunch of, bunch of fat cats. You know, so generally, you know, for, you know, the clients, people have to have, you know, at least some, you know, investable money. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just thought that there was a real opportunity. And I still think, I mean, I don't know. I mean, how he's going in the polls, and I know he's raising money now, so he's certainly not having a problem raising money. At first I thought, hey, if we could just give him some money, he can get the message out. He's certainly got money. He's got plenty of money now. He's getting some attention in the media. And so he's got a shot. I mean, people are going to write him off. He hasn't got a prayer, you know, but we'll see. But I endorse him because I thought maybe he actually could win, and we might as well give a shot at it, even if it's a long shot at something.
Yeah, I agree.
And even if he doesn't win, the key, I think, to Ron Paul's campaign is what's going to happen in the next presidential campaign. You know, I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, came in there and, you know, I mean, I think that what sowed the seeds for Ronald Reagan was Barry Goldwater, and he got slaughtered, but he got the nomination, but he maybe changed the direction of the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Ronald Reagan, you know, he challenged Governor Ford, President Ford. He didn't get the nomination, but again, that made it possible for him to get the nomination and win in 1980. No, unfortunately, you know, Ronald Reagan, you know, took the Barry, the moniker or the baton from Barry Goldwater and basically dropped it. I mean, once he got into office, he didn't do any of the things that he promised to do.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate because he actually had the opportunity. He was elected to dismantle government, and instead, he didn't do it.
Yeah, it expanded under him.
The thing is that Ron Paul would actually follow through with his promise, you know, if he were elected, or if he doesn't get elected this time, maybe, I don't know if he'll run again because he's getting pretty old, but maybe somebody else will be able to pick up the baton from Ron Paul 4 years from now, or 8 years from now, and actually get elected and actually do what Ronald Reagan said he would do but never did.
Yeah, I agree. All right, my other question was about, I hold some student debt here, and I was thinking it would probably...
Don't pay it off.
Yeah, exactly. Wait for inflation to pay for it, right?
Yeah, just how much is your debt?
About 35.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes, is it large enough that you can consolidate it?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely consolidate. You can consolidate into a 30-year loan. Do it.
All right.
Because a few years from now, you won't even notice the loan payments.
Right, that's what I'm hoping for.
Like, you know, what should I do with this? Should I spend this money on a pack of chewing gum or make my student loan payment?
Yeah, exactly.
Whatever you do, don't pay it now.
All right, thanks, Peter. I appreciate it.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's take the final commercial break, and we'll be back for another segment. I think the lines are open, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597.
Euro-Pacific Capital is an independent brokerage firm on a mission to inform its client base and prospective clients about economic and market events that could affect their financial security. Euro-Pacific Capital seeks to provide solutions which are intended to provide safety, not risk. Solutions designed to protect our clients and their families from the U.S. government and its inflationary practices. The time to act is now, while you still have the opportunity to get your money out of the dollar. It's legal to do so, and after a consultation with one of Euro-Pacific's brokers, you will understand how this decision could ensure your financial security. We offer a full array of services ranging from retirement and trust accounts to complete financial planning, checking accounts with or without debit cards, and life insurance, even annuities. With our independent, no-nonsense investment advice that's a cut above the run-of-the-mill commentary that is passed for research for far too long on Wall Street, we suspect investors will find a home at Euro-Pacific Capital.
Hi, I am back. And again, the number is 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. And let me take the next caller. We've got Steve from Delaware.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing. Thanks for calling.
I got just a couple questions. I guess I'll just get right to it. My main concern is protecting my financial future for myself and for my family. And I was wondering, as a relatively new to investing, someone basically starting from scratch, do you feel that getting into stocks in the Asian market, specifically India, are a good bet to make some gains on the value of their stock market?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think some of the emerging markets like India, some of these stocks might be a little hot right now. Some of these markets have, you know, really moved up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's certainly bubbles brewing in some of the emerging markets because of all the money that's being created to artificially prop up the dollar. And so there could be a deflation, you know, as, you know, in those markets, and prices could come down. But, you know, certainly from a long-term perspective, I think people will do very well investing there. I mean, most of the investments that I'm advising my clients right now are to be more defensive. I mean, to stay
right,
kind of clear of most of the emerging markets and instead invest in the mature developed markets and very, you know, conservative, low PE, high yielding assets, looking for potential better opportunities down the line to step up and pick up the more aggressive stocks, because I do think there's going to be a lot of problems, and I think there's going to be a big shakeup, and I think the key is to have real stuff with good dividends. And, you know, I just don't like paper currencies. That's one of the big, you know, flaws I find in the arguments for a lot of the people who keep talking about this deflation and, you know, that somehow the dollar is the salvation, that if we just keep our wealth in paper dollars, that we're going to be better, that everything is going to be okay. And I just don't have that kind of confidence in a currency, especially the currency of the world's largest debtor. And debtor nations have a tendency to create a lot of inflation because that's what benefits them. You know, deflation or sound money, or, you know, when money raises in value, that benefits the creditor who's owed the money. But deflation or inflation benefits the debtors who owe the money. And I don't think that we're going to pursue any policies that reward creditors and punish debtors. I mean, that just wouldn't be in the political interest of any of our politicians, and it doesn't seem like, based on anything that we've done in the past, that's what we're going to do. We're not about, our politicians aren't about fessing up to problems and asking people to make sacrifices and suck it up. They want to play Santa Claus.
Right.
And
so
it's very dangerous to be a saver or a creditor in a currency, you know, with this type of Federal Reserve and this kind of government.
Right, and I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I've read your book, and what I'm getting at is, what you're saying is really best to stick with something in Europe or...
No, don't avoid Asia. We're buying some good, solid Hong Kong-based companies that have very large exposures to China. We're just not buying the high flyers. I'm buying more solid businesses. And we're also investing in Singapore with a lot of exposure to mainland Chinese market. And, of course, a lot of the stuff we're buying in Australia, a lot of these companies, their main export market is China. You know, I'm buying companies, I'm investing in companies that sell to China. Because, again, what I'm looking forward to is increased purchasing power of the Chinese. As the Chinese begin to enjoy the fruits of their labor and live a better lifestyle, they're going to consume a lot more. So rather than investing in an economy that buys from the Chinese, like America, you're much better off in the economies that sell to the Chinese.
Right, but do you believe someone like China would look to a place like India for value on their end?
Well, it depends. I mean, yeah, there's certain things in India that they do well, and there's, you know, certain services that they have a comparative advantage in that they could supply to the Chinese. But, you know, I mean, India is a very difficult market to invest in, and so we don't have much money there. There's a couple of funds that we own, but, you know, it's much easier to invest in Hong Kong and Singapore than it is to invest in India. And I think the Chinese fundamentally have a sounder economy than the Indians.
Right.
But I'm bullish on that whole part of the world, and I'm bullish on the Middle East and, you know, what's going on over there.
Okay, so someone who's just relatively starting out, you would just say stick with the
mature markets and be diversified. The important thing is not to lose money right now, not to lose wealth. So play it safe. You know, get some yield, get dividends coming in foreign currencies that are going to gain value against the dollar. And, you know, if you want to have some money in case all the currencies go down the drain, then you have some money in gold. But even if there's inflation all over the world, see, that's why I think my portfolios do so well. I think even if there is a lot of inflation, even in other countries, I think an electric utility, a refinery, an office building, these things are still going to maintain real value, you know.
Right.
But the reason I don't want to have those assets in America is because the real value of an asset, like let's say a utility or a REIT, has to do with how much can people pay to use them. How much can our businesses able to pay in rent? How much are consumers or businesses able to afford in electricity? And I don't want to own those assets in America right now because Americans are going to be increasingly unable to afford those things, or at least relative to the rest of the world, the rest of the world's ability to consume is going to grow relative to America's ability, where they are right now. So therefore, assets on a global basis are going to gain value outside the United States, and they're going to lose value in the United States, even if all currencies in the world collapse together.
Right. And as far as gold, I haven't really researched that far back, but it seems that, like, as over the last couple of days, the price has spiked just a bit. Do you think that traditional?
I think the charts look good. I've been saying this, to people. I think the technicals look very good for gold and silver. They look very good for oil. You know, oil had that, it got up to 99 and change. People were saying, oh, 100's a sure thing, 100's a sure thing. Next thing you knew, we were back down below 90, and everybody would say, okay, it's over. It's all over. We're going back down to 60. We're going back down to 50. And now we built a nice base, and now we're back up to 96, 97. I think we're headed through. I think the next time we get to 100, we're going right through it. And I think we could move up in the first quarter of next year. I think oil prices can go up to $115 a barrel potentially before we have another major pullback, maybe back down to 105 to 100 or so. But I think the next stop is 110 to 115 on oil.
Right.
I think in that environment we could see gold certainly move through 850 and maybe even move up, you know, to $1,000 an ounce even in the first quarter. I think it looks strong. I think silver could break out. And if silver really takes a move, I don't think it would take much to push silver prices up to $20 an ounce.
Do you think the kind of yearly trends that you might see in gold where it raises a bit around Christmas time and then falls off afterwards?
I don't know. I don't try to figure out any kind of cyclicality and any kind of trends. I mean, if people want to try to, you know, do some short-term trading, they think those things are helpful. I look at longer-term, bigger picture, but I can
right.
see, you know, certain patterns, technical patterns developing, you know, and I think the market looks strong. And generally, you know, what's going on, I expect the U.S. dollar to resume its decline. You know, what's happened recently is a lot of, you know, a month ago or when, you know, when the news was out there and the dollar was hitting 150 against the euro and the Canadian dollar was at 110, we did get a lot of press coverage of the weakness of the dollar, and a lot of people were talking about it. And so a lot of people, I guess, short-term got a little bit too bearish on the dollar, and whenever that happens, there's a bounce. But, you know, the dollar didn't have a meaningful bounce. I mean, the dollar index, which had gotten down to, let's say, 75 and change, got back up to maybe 78, the high 77s, and then now it's already rolling over. So it didn't even get all the way back up to 80, which was the old support. I think this was a very weak bounce. But what actually happened on this bounce, which is very surprising but very negative for the dollar, is that a lot of bullish sentiment developed in the dollar. All of a sudden, we've got a lot of people now who are convinced the dollar has bottomed, who are looking for a rally in the dollar. In fact, one of the main reasons that everybody cites that they think there's going to be a rally is they say that everybody else is expecting it to decline. Well, they might have been expecting it to decline a month and a half ago, but that's not the case now. We've got a lot of people. There's probably as many people arguing for a stronger dollar now as a weaker dollar. And I think, you know, we've built up a lot of positive sentiment in favor of the dollar, and the dollar can therefore collapse. And I think, you know, one of the ways that a lot of people are going to be confounded by the dollar, even the people who expect it to decline, they're going to be shocked by the magnitude of the decline. The decline is going to be far more substantial than what most people who are negative on the dollar believe.
Right, so
of course, it's also going to be far more disruptive and negative for the U.S. economy than what people believe.
So the minor fluctuations you might see, like in the price of gold, really should just kind of be put off and just get it as soon as you
can. Yeah, and anyway, and so I would get started. Are you a client yet?
I'm just waiting for the Hartford to cough up my funds. So I can...
All right, well, wait. I'd like to have you on board. And you've read the book?
Yes, most certainly.
All right, great. Let me say goodbye. I want to take one last call, and I think we're out of with no more callers. I think we're running out of time.
Great. Thanks for the good work.
Okay, and the last caller will be Pete in Florida. Go ahead, Pete.
Hi, how are you? I've been trying for weeks to get to speak to you. Just it's a little off the subject. It's an old subject you spoke about. You were talking about how much people leverage the mortgages on their house, and you had told a story about the woman who owed $650,000 on a house she had originally paid $100,000 for. Well, I'll tell you what, I would venture, because I've done a lot of research looking to buy houses that are potentially in foreclosure or people can no longer make the payments on. And there are people here who have houses that they bought originally 10 years ago and they owe three times as much as the original price on them. And now they can't get rid of them.
It's
rampant. You don't have to go off on it. I just wanted to toss it in there.
Yeah, well, I pointed this out in my book, that the whole fallacy about the realtors trying to push home ownership on the American public, the original idea, the reason that buying a home financially made sense was because after 30 years you owned it. You didn't own it while you were making the mortgage payments. The bank owned it.
Right.
When you paid off the debt, that's when you owned the house. That's when you could retire because you didn't have to make the payments to the bank anymore. You didn't have any rent or a mortgage. You know, you had your house. But this whole concept of buying a house and continually borrowing money against it so that you always owe more, so that after making your mortgage payments for 10 or 20 years, you're deeper in debt than when you began, this is nonsense. But it was based on this fallacy that real estate prices would always go up, and so it's okay to borrow because the price is going to go up faster.
Right. I know. I just threw that in there because, you were in doubt as to how rampant it was. But my question has got something to do with the currencies. In particular, the British pound. How do you view the British economy? Is it as bad as ours?
It's not as bad as ours, but they do have problems, which is one of the reasons why we don't have much invested in the UK. We only have just a smidgen of money over there. Just to not ignore the pound completely, but we are very, very underweight the British.
Yeah, no, I own a couple of thousand shares of the Merck Fund, which is also posted on your website, and I noticed that the manager he's very underweighted.
The pound is kind of like the UK is like America light. I mean, they've got some of our problems. You know, they've got a trade deficit. They've got a current account deficit. You know, they've got a housing bubble. I just don't think they are, you know, if it was a triage situation, I'd say that, you know, we're the more critical patient. You know, we're in worse shape than are the British. And I still think the British, who knows, they get into trouble. They still might end up joining in on the euro, and that might bail them out. They've got a chance where they might link the pound up with the euro.
Really?
For monetary union, especially if some of the problems start to hit the UK. That might be enough to tip tip them into the euro block, which could really help them out. But unfortunately, there's no such salvation. I mean, I hear people talking about the Amero, but I don't think linking the dollar with the Mexican peso is what's going to...
No, absolutely not. We can't support it. I know the Germans are not against it. So in other words, I'd hoped to get to you a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're running out of time. Only got about 30 seconds, so call again next week. Try to call early in the show. I'll take you top of the...
All right, sir.
And
thank
have you read my book?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, hey, thanks, everybody. The hour goes by quick. Again, if you haven't read my book, Crash Proof, Go on my website and buy it at the bookstore. Go to website is www.europac.net. Call toll-free to talk to a broker at 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922. And Happy New Year, everybody. I'm not sure. I think next time I do the show on Wednesday, it will be 2008. So take care for the last show of 2007.